Lecture 10 of the Foundations of Human Experience. Synopsis. The spherical form as a foundation of the three bodily aspects. 1. Head, only physical, spherical form, completely visible. 2. Chest, physical and soul, only visible as a crescent-shaped spherical fragment. 3. Limbs, physical, soul, spiritual, only visible as radii. The head as an expression of intellect, and the limbs as an expression of will. The tubular and bowl-like bones in this connection. The skull as a transformed vertebra. The tubular bones as transformed head bones. The centers of the head, chest, and limb spheres. Head and limbs in connection with cosmic movement. The imitation of cosmic movement in dancing and its translation into music. The origin of sense perceptions and their connection with sculpture and music. Body, soul, and spirit in connection with the head, chest, and limb spheres. The Council of 869. The Catholic Church as the source of scientific materialism. The development of the head from the animal world. The importance that the teacher have a feeling of the connection of human beings with the cosmos. Pedagogy as an art. End of synopsis. Lecture 10, given in Stuttgart, September 1st, 1919. We have already discussed the nature of the human being from the viewpoints of the soul and of the spirit. We have, at least, shed some light on how to consider the human being from the standpoints of the spirit and of the soul. We need to supplement these considerations first by connecting the spiritual, soul, and bodily viewpoints to achieve a complete survey of the human being, and then continuing on to an understanding of external physicality. First, we want to recall something that must have already struck us in various ways, namely that the three aspects of the human being have different forms. We have already noted that the form of the head is spherical, and that the physical nature of the human head lies in this form. We then took note that the human chest is a fragment of a sphere, so that schematically, where the head is a sphere and the chest a crescent moon, clearly this crescent is part of a sphere. We can thus complete the moon form of the human chest. You can correctly envision this middle portion of the human whole only if you consider it a sphere, but a sphere with only a portion, the crescent moon, visible, and the other portion invisible. You may recognize that when ancient people who had the capacity to see forms more clearly than we can now spoke of the head as consonant with the sun, and the chest with the moon, they were not incorrect. Just as you can see only a portion of the sphere when the moon is not full, in the same way you can see only a fragment of the middle human aspect in the form of the chest. Excuse me. You can see that the form of the human head in the physical world is relatively complete. The head shows itself physically as something completed. In a certain sense, it is what it appears to be, and hides the least of itself. The human chest hides quite a bit of itself, leaving a portion of its nature invisible. To understand human nature, it is very important to recognize that a major portion of the chest is invisible. The chest reveals its physicality only on one side, that is, toward the rear. Toward the front, it blends into the soul state. The head is only body. The human chest is body toward the rear and soul toward the front. We carry a real body only in our head as it rests upon our shoulders. We have body and soul by separating the physical chest from the remainder of the chest aspect and allowing it to be acted upon by the soul. The third aspect of the human being is the limbs. From the standpoint of external observation, the limbs are set into the other two aspects, particularly into the torso. How can we understand the nature of the human limbs? We can understand the nature of the human limbs only when we imagine that parts that differ from those remaining in the chest are left over from the spherical form. A portion of the periphery remains in the chest, What remain for the limbs are more from the inside of the sphere, the radii. The core of the sphere is attached as limbs. As I have already said, simply inserting one thing into another schematically will not achieve much. You must always intertwine things, because that is what enlivens them. We have the limb nature of the human being embodied in the limbs. But you see, the head also has limbs. If you really look at the skull, for example, you will find that the upper and lower jaw bones are set onto the skull. They are really attached like limbs. The skull has its own limbs, the upper and lower jaw bones, and they are attached to the skull like limbs, but they are stunted and are really only bony structures. There is yet another difference. If you look at the limbs of the skull, that is the upper and lower jaw bones, you will notice that what are important are the bones themselves. If you look at the limbs attached to the entire body, at the real nature of the human limbs, you will find their essence in their clothing of muscles and blood vessels. In a sense, the bones of the arms and legs, hands and feet, are only inserted into the muscles and blood vessels. The muscles and blood vessels in the upper and lower jaws, the limbs of the head, are stunted. What does this mean? As we have already heard, the organ of will lies in the blood and muscles. Therefore the arms and legs, hands and feet, are developed for the will. What primarily serve the will, namely blood and muscles, are to a certain extent removed from the limbs of the head, because what should develop... What primarily serve the will, namely blood and muscles, are to a certain extent removed from the limbs of the head, because what should develop tend toward the intellect and thinking cognition. Thus, if you want to study the expression of the will in physical forms, you will study the arms and legs, hands and feet. If you want to study how intelligence is revealed to the world, then you will study the head as a skull, as a bony structure, and how limb-like structures, like the upper and lower jaw bones, are connected with the head. You can always see external forms as revelations of inner things, and you can understand them only when you see them as revelations of inner things. I have found that most people have great difficulty comprehending the relationship between the tubular arm and leg bones and the bowl-like bones of the head. It is good in this regard for teachers to learn a concept that lies far from normal life. Thus, we come to something very difficult, perhaps the most difficult thing we need to imagine, and something that we must get past in these pedagogical lectures. You know that Goethe first turned his attention to the so-called vertebral theory of the skull. What does that mean? It means he used metamorphic thinking in connection with the human being and its form. If you consider the human backbone, you will see that one vertebra sits upon the other. We can remove one vertebra and its horns and passage for the spinal cord. From his observation of a sheep's skull in Venice, Goethe perceived that all the bones of the head were transformed vertebra. That means that if you think of a vertebra and push it and pull it in various ways, you will create the bowl-like form of the skull. This insight made a great impression upon Goethe and was very important for him, because he had to conclude that the skull is a transformed, a more developed spinal column. You can relatively easily see that the skull arises out of a metamorphosis of the backbone. However, it is relatively difficult to comprehend the limb bones, even the limb bones of the head, that is the upper and lower jaw, as a transformation of the vertebra or skull. Goethe attempted this, but in a very superficial way. Why is that? It is because a tubular bone is also a metamorphosis or a transformation of the skull, but in a quite particular way. You can relatively easily picture a vertebra transformed into a skull, in that you think of the individual parts enlarged or reduced. However, it is not so easy to get the shape of tubular arm or leg bones from the bowl-shaped skull. You must use a certain procedure to achieve that. You must use the same procedure with tubular arm or leg bones that you would use when you put on a sock or a glove and first turn it inside out. It is relatively easy to imagine how a glove or a sock looks when turned inside out, but tubular bones are not uniform. They are not so thin-walled as to be uniform inside and out. They are made differently on the inside and outside. If you made a sock in the same way and then made it elastic so that you could artistically form it with all kinds of bumps and dents and then turned it inside out, you would no longer have the same form on the outside as the inside. It is the same with tubular bones. You must turn the inside toward the outside and the outside toward the inside. What results is the form of the skull. The human limbs are not only a transformation of the skull, they are, in addition, a skull turned inside out. Why is that so? It is so because the head has its center somewhere inside. It is concentric. The chest does not have its midpoint in the middle of the crescent. The midpoint of the chest lies very far away. The sketch only partially indicates this, since it would be very large if it were completely drawn. The chest has its center very far away. Where does the midpoint of the limb system lie? Now we come to the second difficulty. The midpoint of the limbs lies in the complete circumference. The middle point of the limbs is actually a sphere, the opposite of a point. It is a spherical surface. The middle is actually everywhere. And this is the reason that you can turn in every direction and that the radii enter from every direction. They are united with you. What is in the head arises out of the head. But what occurs in the limbs unites itself with you. For this reason, I said in another lecture, that you must think of the limbs as being set into you. We are really a whole universe. Only what wants to enter us is concentrated at its end and becomes visible. A very small portion of what we are becomes visible in our limbs. Enough for the limbs to be something corporeal, but actually only a scintilla of what exists in the human limb system, namely the spirit. The body, soul, and spirit exist in the human limb system. The body is only hinted at in the limbs. However, they also contain the soul as well as the spirit, which in principle encompasses the entire universe. We can also make another sketch of the human being. We can view the human being as a gigantic sphere that encompasses the entire universe, then a smaller sphere, and then a still smaller sphere. Only the smallest sphere is completely visible. The somewhat larger sphere is only partially visible. The largest sphere is visible only at the end of its radii, and the remainder is invisible. In this way, the form of the human being is created out of the universe. In the central system, in the chest, we have the head united with the limbs. If you look at the backbone and the connection to the ribs, you will see that toward the front, there is an attempt at closure. In the back, everything is closed. However, toward the front, there is only an attempt at closure. The closer the ribs are to the head, the better they achieve closure, and the lower they lie, the more they fail at this. The last ribs do not come together at all because the outside forces that enter the limbs act against it. The Greeks were still quite conscious that the human being is connected with the entirety of the macrocosm. The Egyptians also knew this very well, only they knew it abstractly. When you look at Egyptian sculpture, or at old statues in general, you can see the expression of this cosmic thought. You cannot understand what people in ancient times did if you do not know that their actions were consistent with their beliefs, namely that the head is a small sphere, a miniaturized heavenly body, and that the limbs are a radial piece of the entire cosmos entering the human form. The Greeks had a beautiful and harmonious picture of this, which is why they were good sculptors. Today you cannot really understand human sculpture unless you are aware of the connection of the human being with the cosmos. Otherwise you only fumble around with external natural forms. From what I just said, you will recognize that the limbs incline more toward the cosmos and the head more toward the individual human being. However, toward what do the limbs tend? They tend toward the cosmos, in which the human being moves and continually changes position. They have a relationship to cosmic movement. You must understand that the limbs have a relationship to cosmic movement. When we move around in the cosmos and perform deeds, we are limb human beings. What does cosmic movement have to do with our head? I already mentioned that, from another perspective, the head rests upon the shoulders. The head has the task of stilling the continuous movement of the cosmos. You can imagine yourself in your head by picturing yourself sitting in a train. The train moves forward, and you sit quietly within it. In the same way, your soul sits in your head as it allows the limbs to move it about and brings an inner stillness to this movement. Just as you can stretch out and rest in the train, if you have sufficient room, perhaps even a sleeping car, despite the fact that this rest is not true rest, since you are moving rapidly through the world, nevertheless you have a feeling of resting. In the same way, the head calms what the limbs accomplish as cosmic movement. The chest is in the middle and mediates movement in the external world with what the head brings to rest. Now imagine we human beings want to imitate cosmic movement with our limbs. What do we do then? We dance. In reality, we dance. What we commonly call dancing is only a fragmentary kind of dancing. All dancing arises out of the human limb's imitation of the movements of the planets and other heavenly bodies, including the earth itself. However, what do the head and chest do when we imitate cosmic movements through dancing? In the head and chest, it is as if we stifled our movements in the world. They cannot continue through the chest into the head because this fellow is sitting on our shoulders and does not allow movements to continue on into the soul. The soul has to participate in movement from a state of rest because the head rests upon the shoulders. What does the soul do then? It begins to reflect upon the dancing of the limbs. It starts to growl when the limbs perform irregular movements. It begins to murmur when the limbs move rhythmically. And it begins to sing when the limbs move in harmony with the cosmic movements of the universe. In this way, dancing is transformed outwardly into song and inwardly into music. Unless sense physiology accepts the cosmic nature of the human being, it will never comprehend perception. It will never know how the movements in the air are connected with music. It will always maintain that movements are out there in the air and that people perceive music inwardly. That is what physiology and psychology texts state, the only difference being that one does so at the end and the other at the beginning. Where does this come from? It arises out of the fact that people who practice psychology or physiology do not know that what people outwardly express in movement, they inwardly bring to rest in the soul, and thus begin to transform into tones. It is the same with other sense perceptions, because the organs in the head do not participate in external movement. They reflect these movements back into the chest and transform them into tones, into other sense perceptions. This is the origin of all feeling, and is also the connection with the arts. The musical arts arise from the sculptural and architectural arts, because the sculptural and architectural arts are outwardly what the musical arts are inwardly. The musical arts are the reflection of the world from within outwards. This is how people exist amid the cosmos. Feel a color as a movement that has come to rest. Just as when you stretch out in a train and have the illusion that you are at rest, you do not externally perceive the movement. You allow the train to move along. Through fine, imperceptible movements of the limbs, you allow your body to participate in the outer world, while inwardly you perceive only colors and tones. You owe this to the fact that your head as a form is carried in rest by the limbs. As I have already said, what I have to tell you here is rather difficult. It is particularly difficult because absolutely nothing is done in our time to comprehend these things. Everything we currently understand as education is done so that people remain unknowledgeable about these things. What actually occurs through our modern education? People cannot fully understand a sock or a glove without turning it inside out because they will not know what touches their skin in the sock or glove. They will know only what is on the outside. In the same way, modern education teaches people to know only what is turned toward the outside, and they have a concept for only half a human being. They cannot comprehend even the limbs, because the limbs are the spirit turned inside out. What we have presented today, we can also characterize in a different way. If we look at the whole human being standing before us in the world, first as a limb being, we find ourselves presented with spirit, soul, and body. If we look at the human being as a chest being, we are presented with soul and body. The large sphere, spirit, body, soul. The smaller sphere, body, soul. And the smallest sphere, body only. At the Council of 869, the bishops of the Catholic Church forbade humanity to know anything about the large sphere. At that time, they declared it a dogma of the Catholic Church that only the middle-sized and smallest spheres existed, that human beings consisted only of body and soul, and that the soul merely contained something spiritual. According to this view, the soul is also spirit-like. Since 869, spirit ceased to exist for the Occidental culture arising from Catholicism. However, by removing the relationship to the spirit, the relationship of the human being to the cosmos was also severed. The human being was driven more and more into egotism. Therefore, religion itself became increasingly egotistical. And we now live in a time when we must again, through spiritual observation, encounter the relationship of human beings to the spirit, and thus to the cosmos. Who is actually responsible for the present scientific materialism? Since the Catholic Church banished the spirit at the Council of Constantinople in 869, it carries the primary responsibility for our scientific materialism. What actually occurred then? Look at the human head. It has so developed in the course of world events that it is today the oldest aspect of the human being. The head arose out of the higher and, going still further back, out of the lower animals. Regarding our head, we are descendants of the animal world. There is nothing more to say. The head is simply a more developed animal. We return to the world of the lower animals if we want to seek the predecessors of our heads. The chest was added to the head later and is not as animalistic. We received the chest only later. As human beings, we acquired the limbs as the latest organs, and they are the most human. They are not transformed animal organs, but were added later. The animalistic organs were formed independently from the cosmos to the animals, and the human organs were later added independently to the chest. However, because the Catholic Church wanted to hide the relationship of the human being to the cosmos, that is, the true nature of the human limbs, it carried only a small amount of the chest and more of the head or skull into the following ages. Thus materialism came to the idea that the skull descended from the animals and now speaks of the idea that the entire human being descended from animals, whereas the chest and limb organs developed only later. Particularly because the Catholic Church wanted to hide the nature of the human limbs and their connection to the cosmos, it induced a later materialistic time to fall into the idea that only the head has any meaning, and that it represents the entire human being. In truth, the Catholic Church is the creator of materialism in the study of evolution. It is particularly important that modern teachers know such things, because they should connect their interests with what has occurred in the world. They should know the foundations of things that have occurred in the world. Today, we have attempted to clarify how our era became materialistic by beginning with something quite different, namely with the sphere, the crescent, and the radial form of the limbs. That is, we began with something apparently at the opposite pole in order to clarify a large, overpowering historical fact. This is necessary so that particularly the teacher, who otherwise can accomplish nothing with the growing child, is able to grasp cultural facts by the roots. Teachers can then take up something necessary to proper teaching through their unconscious and subconscious relationships to children. Teachers can then properly respect the human form and see it everywhere in relationship to the cosmos. They can approach the human form differently than when they see it only as a better formed animal body. Today, teachers, even though they often give in to illusions when in their studies, basically stand before the children with a clear awareness that the growing child is a young calf or small animal, and that they are to develop this little animal a little further than nature has done. Teachers will feel differently when they say to themselves that here is a human being from whom relationships extend to the out to the entire cosmos, and that when I do my work with every one of these growing children, I do something that has meaning for the entire universe. We are in the classroom, and within every child lies a center of the universe. The classroom is a center, yes, even many centers for the macrocosm. Think to yourselves how alive this feels and what it means. Think about how the idea of the cosmos and its connection to the human being becomes a feeling that makes each act of teaching holy. If we do not have such feelings about human beings and the cosmos, we cannot seriously and properly teach. At the moment when we have such feelings, they are carried through sub-earthly bonds to the children. In another regard, I mentioned that it is a thing filled with wonder to see that the earth conducts electricity without wires when wires are attached to copper plates in the earth. If you go to school with only egotistical human feelings, then you will need all sorts of wires, words, to communicate with the children. If you have the great cosmic feelings that unfold such ideas as we have just developed, then a sub-earthly conductor goes to the child. Then you are one with the children. This is part of the mysterious relationship between you and all school children. We must base what we call pedagogy upon such feelings. Pedagogy may not be a system. It must be an art. Where is an art we can learn without continuously living and feeling? However, the feelings in which we must live in order to practice that great art of life that is pedagogy, the feelings that we must have for pedagogy, are brought to life only through an observation of the cosmos and its connection with the human being. The end of Lecture 10.